This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, I'm Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, action, exploitation, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1970s to today. Be sure and check out reallyawfulmovies.com for reviews, interviews, lists, and terrific movie giveaways. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 29, They Live.
They Live, otherwise known as John Carpenter's They Live. Now, John Carpenter is, without a doubt, a bona fide master of horror. I mean, the guy is, as far as I'm concerned, one of the best directors. I mean, the guy has made so many incredible movies, most in the horror genre, but, I mean, some would branch into sci-fi. Movies such as, like, Halloween, The Fog, Prince of Darkness, Escape from New York, Big Trouble in Little China, Christine, Starman, and The Immortal, The Thing. Mm-hmm. Now, but the film we're going to talk about today is this little scrappy movie he made in 1988, starring a wrestler that he made for $4 million. So it's a low-budget film, and it's They Live. And in my opinion, this is one of Carpenter's best. Mm-hmm. I love this movie. This is another, I mean, it's funny, because a couple episodes ago, we talked about RoboCop, and we said that was sort of like a late 80s incisive, you know, Reagan-era satire, and this one, too. I mean, this is a very incisive satire.
I was going to just ask, before we get to the plot here, did you ever have a chance to meet Carpenter?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
I met Carpenter.
What were the circumstances?
It was Fan Expo again. I mean, when I say met him, I stood in line and for about 2 hours, and I went up to him, and I shook his hand, and I... you know, maybe he said, buh, 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 and I got his autograph, but yeah.
Hey, still, that's something.
Yep.
What did he autograph for you?
He autographed Thing 8x10. No, sorry, Halloween 8x10.
Wow. Oh, yep. That's amazing.
Yep.
And we referenced the Thing earlier, one of the all-time best soundtracks ever. And, you know, The Fog and The Thing are sort of unfairly maligned by people. But
well, if that's the worst that he can do,
that's the best Joel Schumacher can do.
I'm going to have to contradict you there, because The Fog is maligned. The Thing was maligned upon its original release, but it has now been reconsidered as a bona fide classic. I mean, it was a flop upon its first release, but I mean, The Thing nowadays, I mean, you ask any horror fan worth their salt, they're going to say The Thing is one of the best films they've ever seen. Now, it's interesting you bring up the soundtrack of The Thing, because The Thing was scored by Morricone. Mm-hmm. And Carpenter is interesting, because he's a composer in his own right. And he's you know, I mean, the iconic Halloween theme, you know, that was Carpenter.
That's amazing, yeah.
And when this movie begins, They Live, it begins almost like a bit of a Western, in the sense that the music was not composed by Morricone. I believe it was composed by Carpenter, but it was very Morricone-esque. And you have this man who sort of walks into town.
Yeah.
And he's like a drifter. You know? And this is almost like your
quintessential... The High Plains drifter. He's a Western.
Yeah, and he literally is a man with no name.
Yeah.
In the sense that in the entire movie, not once is he ever named. Now, if you look at the closing credits, the name they give him is Nada.
Hmm.
Spanish being...
Yeah, nothing. Yeah.
So he is. I mean, he's the man with no name. And this man is played by famed pro wrestler Rowdy Piper.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, we're wrestling fans. I mean, I can't say I'm a big fan of the current product, but I mean, growing up, wrestling was you know, it was a huge part of my life. I mean, I was there at WrestleMania 6 in the Sky Dome, you know, the immortal, you know, contest between, like, the Immovable Object and the Unstoppable Force.
Unstoppable Force versus
Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah.
I mean, and of course, Piper was all...
Piper was there, too, and the Ultimate Warrior had three moves, one of which included shaking the rope.
Yeah. But, well, not the longest moveset was any better than that.
Yeah, he had four.
He had about four or five, but yeah. But, I mean, Rowdy Piper, I mean, whether he was the villain or the hero, I mean, the guy was always... He was incredible. He was always
incredibly charismatic on the mic with Piper's pit and everything. Mm-hmm. He was just... Yeah, he just carried the day for years there. You know, great worker, too.
Great worker, and, I mean, look, it's funny because, I mean, Hogan and Piper, I mean, they're not exactly what you would say the best of friends, in the sense that they're both men with healthy egos. And, you know, I mean, when it comes to, who is the most famous wrestler of all time in the mainstream, most people will say Hulk Hogan, yeah. Right? Everyone knows Hulk Hogan. Rowdy Piper, I mean, it's his contention that there would be no hero if not for the villain, right?
Yeah, and for sure.
By being the sort of, you know, adversary to Hogan, he made Hogan. And I tend to agree with Piper. And the interesting thing is that, I mean, there have been many wrestlers that have tried to make the leap into movie superstardom, Hogan being one of them. And, I mean, most of his movies, if not all of them, were absolutely terrible crap.
Yeah.
I mean, the only... and we're going to do a future podcast, actually, about, like, shitty movies that star wrestlers.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, with the exception of, let's say, like...
The Rock.
The Rock, of course. Yeah. Well, he's in a different league altogether.
Yeah.
But, like, I would say, like, Andre the Giant and the Princess Bride, or Ventura in a couple of those Schwarzenegger films that he was in. Like,
yeah, Predator. Predator, yeah.
Iron Man. I mean, there's not very many credible performances by pro... Terry Funk. Okay, Terry Funk was in a number of Stallone movies.
Yeah, as well as Roadhouse.
Yeah. We'll do a
we're going to do a Roadhouse podcast in the future. But Pain Don't Hurt.
There you go, exactly.
Poor Dalton. Patrick Swayze.
Oh, that's
such a damn shame.
May he rest in peace, yes, right?
Indeed.
But again, there's not very many credible performances by wrestlers in the movies. This, in my opinion, arguably could be the best performance by a wrestler in a movie.
For sure.
This is Rowdy Piper playing the man with no name.
Yeah, or Kafka-esque. Mm-hmm. Like K in one of the Kafka novels. Yeah, he's Nada. He's he's a man who's in need of work.
Mm-hmm.
And arrives. They
live. So give it. Let's do a little precis of the plot.
He arrives in L.A. Mm-hmm. He's a blue collar guy.
Yep, he was
just like
off.
His wrestling persona. Mm-hmm. He was laid off. He needs construction work.
Yep,
and so he tries to get day work.
Yep. Yeah, he's kind of like a migrant worker, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
And I'm talking about like this being a very incisive satire of Reaganomics. I mean, so we're looking at a world right now, again, this was made in 1988, right, where, you know, the trickle-down theory, you know Reagan's famous trickle-down theory, right, where if the rich get richer, eventually that will trickle down to the poor and, you know, they'll get some money. Well, no, I mean, in this movie, the American Dream doesn't exist. Trickle-down theory is a fucking sham, and, you know, TV is the opiate of the masses, right? Mm-hmm. So, we have our character, our hero, and I guess for lack of a better word, we'll call him Nada.
Mm-hmm.
And he's looking for work, and he finds some work, and he's working at a construction site, and he meets up with a guy by the name of Frank, played by Keith David, who has been in a number of movies, but he was also in The Thing. And they strike a bit of a friendship. But throughout this whole thing, you know, there's this church, you know, this sort of weird little church across the street from the construction site, and it attracts Nada's attention because he sees people going in and out of the
church. Yeah, there's gospel music emanating from it, and it turns out that's just a recording.
Right.
And it's basically a front, you know, we'll get into that.
Because we have these revolutionaries, right? And as I was saying before, TV being the opiate of the masses, mm-hmm. you know, every so often they're watching their, you know, soap opera would have very heavy, and you have this, like, you know, this guerrilla broadcast being, you know, cutting in, and, you know, they're saying, you're all being lied to, everything's a sham, da-da-da, we have to stand up, we have to revolt, etc. And it turns out that this is actually the episode.
The headquarters. These dispatches. Mm-hmm. Dispatches.
Yep.
Pardon me.
So, you know, the other thing with Piper's character, not only does he want a place to work, he wants a place to live, and Keith David's character, Frank, ends up directing him to this sort of, like, kind of like shantytown,
right on the outskirts of L.A., yeah.
Right, and actually, it was across the shantytown where this church was, not across from the construction site.
Mm-hmm.
And, all of a sudden, I mean, martial law, you know, and, the cops are bearing down, and, you know, they destroy the shantytown, they destroy the church, and everything's happening. And in the ensuing sort of exodus and trying to, you know, save your own hide, our hero comes across a pair of sunglasses.
Yep.
Actually, a box of sunglasses. And it's funny because earlier on, there's a character who's a preacher. He's a blind preacher. He's one of these guys that, like, you know, pontificates and, you know, on his soapbox, right? We see many of these people, you know, here in Toronto, the big city, you know, Jesus, it will save, right? And this guy's, you know, he's like a revolutionary.
Yeah, and if someone's evangelizing, I automatically give them more credibility if they're blind somehow. Maybe it's an ancient Greece thing. I don't know what, but
he's like, you know, Clarissa or something. You know, yeah. Oracle. But what's interesting though is that, I mean, this man is literally blind, but not as figuratively blind in the sense that, and so is everybody else. They don't know what is going around them, right?
Yeah.
Until Piper dons the glasses, and all of a sudden, he was once blind. Lord, now I can see. And what does he see?
Well, it's like Marshall McLuhan, as we've discussed in our earlier podcast, sunglasses, and, you know, the cool versus hot media. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess, you know, not inviting people into what you can see by being sort of a cool, distant, detached character. But this flips that on its ear. He can see.
He sees the truth.
The truth.
Right.
And I guess he can see UFOs. He can see people who, I guess some people have, instead of human faces, they have skulls with their skins just removed.
Yeah, they're basically just skull faces. Alien countenances. And I mean, these are all like, you know, the elite, right? So like most of the elite in society are
The 1%ers.
Yeah, exactly. Although a few cops as well, but they're the ones. But I mean, yeah, so they're basically aliens. And not only that, but I mean, he sees all these messages, right? Stuff like, you know, obey and consume and submit and, you know, no independent thought and buy and stay asleep and very Orwellian in a sense, you know.
These it's interesting. You know, that's kind of, I don't know if that's sort of an interesting conceit, because why should you have to tell people to consume? I mean, look at Black Friday. You have people literally stomping each other to death in order to you know, to get the latest deals, and it's presumably the same in the UK. But
again,
in North American shores, my God, avoid your Targets and your Walmarts on Black Friday, because someone will trample you to death. But anyway, it's still an interesting idea.
But look, I mean, look,
like the other end.
And this is the 80s. I mean, this is the era of Wall Street. Mm-hmm. This is the era of Gordon Gekko, Greed is Good. And when Piper's donning the glass, he looks down on a few bills, a few notes. And what does it say? This is your God.
This is your God, yeah.
Right?
Mammon.
So he, at this point, I mean, he sees what's really going on. And it's pretty, you know, it, all of a sudden, like, he has, like, it blows his mind, right? And, you know, he now, as I said before, he was once blind, now he can see, right?
So now he can see, and he sees, again, these skull creatures, and he sees UFOs, I guess because Carpenter was influenced by The Day the Earth Stood Still. Mm-hmm. So he sees these sort of corny UFOs, and you know, he's a denizen of Bumtown, essentially this sort of, you know, shantytown, which I guess L.A. is almost infamous for Skid Row. I think that's where the term Skid Row originated there.
It wasn't the band? 18 Life, Monkey Business, you know, I remember you.
Oh,
know.
My God. 80s metal always makes an appearance in our podcast. But Charles Bukowski frequently wrote about Skid Row in L.A. and that. So he, you know, after a hard day's work, you know, he goes to his shantytown to try and catch some Z's, and he's got his buddy there, and he's trying to convince him of what he's seen.
But what's interesting though is, I mean, before that, I mean, as Nada is you know, seeing these aliens, and he's not exactly quiet about it. I mean, he's like, you're really ugly, you know. Anyway, so they have this sort of like this communication device, and they're like, ah, if someone can see us, occasional gentleman, etc. All of a sudden Piper's on the run. He goes into a bank, right, with a shotgun.
Yes.
And he utters the immortal line. I mean, this is like, you know, the line from the movie.
Yeah.
I have come here to chew bubble gum
and
kick some ass.
And
I'm all out of bubble gum. Now, I got to say one thing. This line was ad-libbed by Piper on set. It was actually, you know, of course, Piper was famous in wrestling for delivering incredible promos. And he had a whole bunch of promo ideas and lines he was going to say. This was a line he was going to actually, maybe, you know, presumably say against Adrian Adonis or something, right? But he ad-libbed it, and it's become an incredible line.
It's
so
really cool.
Yeah, so, I mean, eventually, I mean, he becomes this wanted man, because he ends up blowing away a lot of these aliens. And him and Keith David reunite, and he wants David to don these glasses.
And he won't have any part of him, because he thinks he's insane.
Exactly. Because
he's gone on the shooting spree, and he says, like, listen, man, you've just lost your mind. And Piper slash Nada implores him, come on, man, just try on these glasses, you'll see what I see. And he won't, and this leads to this...
Well, this is the other takeaway from the film. Like the other incredible thing is one of the most incredible fight scenes in cinematic history. I mean, this thing went on.
Yeah, for... a little ludicrous, a little.
Well, you say it's ludicrous, but yeah. I'm just saying one thing. I mean, it was scripted to be a 20-second fight, okay? But unbeknownst to Carpenter, David and Piper rehearsed this fight for 3 weeks. Okay, and they went at it. I mean, this fight. I mean, with the exception of the face and the groin, they were really going at it, right? And this fight went on and on for 5 minutes and 20 seconds. Incredible!
It's just insane. It's almost Rocky-esque, where someone. I mean, what kind of chin do they have? They always joke about in boxing where you have a glass chin, where you get knocked out with one shot. These guys took numerous, just unbelievable punishment endlessly in this back alley. And then finally, I found it excessive. Maybe other people didn't.
I found it fucking awesome. In fact, I'm not the only one, because Trey Parker, Matt Stone, I mean, I used to watch South Park religiously. I don't watch it anymore, unfortunately, just because I don't even know when it's on. It's always, they're always changing the time slot and whatever. But there was a famous episode called Cripple Fight, okay, where you had these two characters. Were you a South Park fan?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so do you remember Timmy?
Yeah.
You know, the disabled character Timmy? Yeah. And there was another disabled character, Jimmy, right?
Yeah.
And there was an episode where they had a quote-unquote cripple fight where it was Jimmy versus Timmy. I mean, you know, how wrong-headed was he? But it's so great. I mean,
so great.
And they fought, and the fight was a, again, I can't say a shot-by-shot because it's animation, but it was a frame-by-frame recreation of the fight from They Live.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's become iconic. Whether or not you think it's ludicrous, I think it's awesome. It was iconic.
Finally, Nada gets the better of his buddy.
And he puts on the glasses.
Finally puts on the glasses, and then he was blind, but now he can see.
Now he can see, yep. And, you know, they realize that basically these aliens, i.e. these capitalists, I mean, they were basically an allegory for capitalists, politicians, those who... In fact, even the President of the United States was an alien, you know? That they basically owned everything. They controlled everything. And in a lot of ways, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, this is a comment on, like, U.S. imperialism and, you know, consumerism, greed. Another interesting fact.
Well, yeah, okay, go ahead.
No, please.
Oh, I guess, well, if you're using the medium of film, which is arguably the most capitalistic enterprise possible, where you have tons of investors and you're beholden to people going to see your film and spending money on it. So it's interesting that Carpenter would use this vehicle. I don't know what his political sensibilities are, but...
Well, yeah, but that's what I love. I mean, because, I mean, I guess we can assume that Carpenter was a liberal, i.e. maybe a libertarian, whatever.
Well, liberal, I would say, yeah.
Yeah, liberal. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, this film was subversive as can be, right? I mean, and that's what I love. I love subversiveness. And another very interesting thing, I mean, one of the repeated motifs was obey, the word obey. Now, Shepard Fairey. Very famous graffiti street artist, you know, contemporary of Banksy, right?
Banksy, yeah.
He was famous for his depictions of Andre the Giant, and underneath Andre, it would say the word obey.
Yeah.
And he was inspired by They Live for that. So,
interesting.
Yeah, kind of, you know, sort of like a circular inspiration in the sense you have like a wrestler in a movie inspiring a poster about another wrestler with the word obey, and so yeah.
My takeaway message was less a skewering of capitalism, but more John Carpenter's perhaps, maybe I'm reading into this too much, dissatisfaction with the sort of Hollywood bean counters.
Interesting.
And sort of going, oh, these guys are, you know, focus group. We're not going to greenlight your movie unless it's been audience tested and has a viable market for it. So he's sort of decrying a lack of artistic integrity in people in Hollywood. That's the way I read it.
Interesting you say that, because at this, when he made They Live, I mean, he was more or less on the outs of Hollywood. His last two films were big budget flops. I mean, Big Trouble in Little China, which is a great movie.
Yeah.
You know, the studios expected it to be like the next Indiana Jones, and it was a flop. And when he made They Live, it was pretty much his last stab at the Hollywood mainstream, and he made this really subversive movie for $4 million. I remember distinctly as a child watching this movie in the 80s because of the fact that I was a big fan of wrestling and Roddy Piper. I wanted to see this movie.
Yeah.
And I remember it opened at number one It opened at number one. It had an opening weekend gross of $3 million, which is pitiful for a number one movie. And then it just disappeared. Like, it just flopped. You would assume those $3 million came from, like, wrestling fans. And after that, it was a huge flop. And that was the end of that. Carpenter was no longer... He was considered box office poison after this movie. I mean, he made other movies afterwards, but they were never... He was never, you know, the heights of the man that made, like, Halloween and, you know, The Fog and other financially... Christine and other financially successful movies. So, interesting interpretation. And you know what? I mean, hey, that's the great thing about art.
Yeah.
It's open to so many different interpretations. I interpret it as a critique on capitalism, a critique on Reaganomics, a critique on the American imperialism, the way of life. You interpret it as a critique of the film industry?
Yeah, for sure.
Both equally valid. So, once we have our two heroes and they don these glasses, I mean, you know, they're now aware and they see this sort of Orwellian world and they're able, you know, and their goal is to then
get rid of the signal. That's
right.
Yeah.
And then there's also a female character played by Meg Foster, who was fairly distinguished actress. I remember her mostly for starring as Evil-Lyn in the canon production of Masters of the Universe, alongside Dolph Lundgren, but she worked for a television station.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's... They Live. It's an incredible movie. It's subversive. It's got tons of subtext. However you want to interpret it, that's great. You know, watch a movie and interpret it as you will.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit sort of heavy-handed, in my opinion, of just telling people to consume as you don't really need to. But it doesn't matter, because it's creepy as all hell. Uh-huh. When you have two protagonists, well, they find like-minded people in this underground sort of subversive crew who can also see what they see. But it's interesting, even then, if you see people with skulls who are controlling things,
right.
it's fascinating.
But again, they sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, it's all about the greed, right? And one of their fellow residents in the shantytown, played by famous character actor George Buckflower, ends up being bought out by these alien overlords, and he becomes like a sellout, and he becomes, hey, you know, they're the price is right, $1 million man.
Yeah, yeah. but even then, even if they were just aliens taking things over with skulls for heads, and someone sees what you can't see, that alone is enough to make it just an intriguing premise. Even if it's arguably maybe a slight remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Well, you know,
that sort of motif, which I love anyways,
right.
It doesn't matter. It's a twist on that. It's still creepy as hell.
And
your neighbors aren't what they seem.
Right, and this is the greatest thing. This is the thing about great cinema and great art. In general, is that it can work on so many different levels.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to watch it, it's just a great sort of like creature feature sci-fi homage, in the sense that, like, you know, hey, you know, all of a sudden, like, you know, people are really aliens underneath the skin, and you know, and you want to look at that on that level,
yeah,
great. If you want to go a bit deeper and look at the subversive elements, the subtext, you know, your own interpretations, argue that, look at the ideology of the movie, that's in fact fantastic too. I mean, that's what art does.
Interesting depiction of L.A. too, because you have, this is, I don't know as much about L.A. as I do, I'm more familiar with Chicago and New York, but again, maybe to live and die in L.A., but there's a certain mystique that it has, and, you know, South Central and whatnot, that's increasingly being, metastasized by, gentrification and changing cities and whatnot. So you have, again, a glimpse into Skid Row, and we've talked about New York on numerous occasions, where whether it be Basket Case or Maniac, where you see the city in its essence before it just became, I guess you could say, turned over to one percenters in the case of They Live. And it's a different time before cities became homogenized.
Right.
There's parts of Toronto that look like New York, that look like LA, and you don't want to ever encounter a time when cities just all look the same. But this is a gritty, powerful look at LA and the outskirts of LA. And yeah, it's incredible. It's worth seeing.
I will maintain that it's an incisive satire of American society in the Reagan era. And you maintain its incisive satire.
A little heavy-handed, but yeah, it's worth, yeah. It's just because, again, you don't need to tell people to consume, but it's a great idea.
Uh-huh.
And it's impeccably executed. It's action-packed. Dialogue's crackerjack. It's a buddy picture, but with the added benefit of having the buddies just punch the living daylights out of one
another.
And then a pretty incredible performance by Roddy Piper, too.
Oh, yeah. As I said before, one of the most, I would say, one of the best performances by a wrestler in a movie.
So you're not saying, what about The Rock and Scorpion King or something? Or like Hogan and...
You know, and the old Bard?
Yeah, the old Bard.
Trust me, when we do our wrestler cast, we're going to talk about all these shitty movies that Hogan made.
Goldberg and Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2 or whatever. Yeah,
he's pretty
fucking bad.
Look, yeah. I mean, Hogan was... incredible as Thunderlips in Rocky 3, but other than that, I love The Rock. I mean, he's
full of charisma. He's right, just incredible.
The films that he makes, The Scorpion King, The Fast and the Furious,
pretty fucking bad.
They're not the movies I like to watch. Yeah. So, I mean, I've yet to see, if The Rock ever portrays, let's say, King Lear.
Sure, why not?
I think he could do it, you know?
He could do it, yeah.
If you smell what the king is cooking.
Othello, he's perfect. But Roddy Piper brings a certain everyman appeal to it, mullet and toe.
Yeah, it's 80s.
Yeah, just great. Just definitely worth checking out. Yep. Well worth it. And
so, you know what, I mean... What did we learn from this movie? I mean, we like to talk about this.
I thought construction workers were more well compensated, and they wouldn't have to live on the equivalent of whatever LA's Skid Row.
Right.
Well, again, those were different times. Now, for sure, it's a coveted blue collar job right now. But I guess at the time, it's just day work. As the ethnic slur against Italians is "dago," where you go to work for a day.
Uh-huh.
So, I guess it has that. Perception, sort of like a roofer, that it's a job that criminals do, for better or for worse. But, you know, Roddy Piper, he's a drifter, a high plains drifter, comes into town, he's got no work, and he does construction, almost like he's an ex-con.
Yeah. I learned that the carpenter is incredible. Carpenter is God. I love the guy. I mean, I can't say anything facetious about this movie. I think it's a fantastic movie.
And his output has declined a little bit in his advanced age. I wish the guy had another 30 years in him. Because he's just, I mean, it's hard. You know, we discussed in an earlier podcast, you know, movies that have been influenced by Halloween. It's just, it's hard to beat. Like, he basically wrote the template for 80s slasher films in Halloween. The guy is a genius.
He is. He's fantastic. And I do think, I mean, his last film, The Ward, was very underwhelming, but he is working outside the studio system right now, and I do think the Carpenter has one or two more great films within him, so I look forward to seeing those.
And hell, we might get a chance to talk to him. I hope we do. We're gonna put our feelers out, and hopefully we'll bring that to you soon.
For sure. So, star rating, I'm giving it a live.
4 and above, again, and anything that's just, you know, incredibly compelling, interesting, just a genre classic for sure.
Exactly. And I'm going to give it just a little bit more. I'm going to say 4.5 just because of the incisive satire, I mean, and the subtext. So, yeah. I mean, this is another one that we're going to recommend really, really high. So, for more, check out...
reallyawfulmovies.com. Check us out for lists, movie giveaways, reviews, Monday, Wednesday, sometimes Thursdays. Mm-hmm. And we'd love your feedback, too. reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.